Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the EG Property Podcast. I'm Sam McClary, editor of EG, and joining me today is UK Regeneration Chief Executive Jackie Seddock and writer and my former boss, Peter Bill. Jackie and Peter have recently co-authored a book taking a good look at Britain's housing crisis. It's a blunt, straightforward and analysis-filled book that looks at the faults, the factoids, the correct use of the word and the fixes. It's called Broken Homes, and if you're interested in the residential sector, house building and why we don't actually have a housing crisis, then you should definitely read it. A link to buy a copy is included in the show notes. Do check it out. But if you fancy an aural journey through the pages of the book and the treat of some no-holds-barred commentary on the sector, then stay with me for the next 50 minutes or so as we discuss how tinkering with the planning system is not the solution, about the need for regulation, we talk about greed, about why we need more brave figureheads in the sector, and why everyone deserves better.
So I am super excited with this EG Property podcast because not only do I get to talk with some straight talking people, the wonderful Jackie Seddock and my former boss, in fact, Mr. Peter Bill. Jackie, Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the EG Property podcast. So we are here today to talk about your book, Broken Homes, and much more, I hope. But I have to start off with a big thank you, because one of the greatest bits that I have enjoyed reading from every page of Broken Homes, I must say, is your proper use of the word factoid, because that gets thrown around so much these days as people thinking it's a fun term for fact, which of course it is not. So thank you for using that in its proper term, which is an item of unreliable information that is reported and repeated so much that we accept it as fact. And we'll go through some of those factoids in the world of Resi shortly. What I also enjoyed very much in the book, though, Peter, is your description of Jackie. So you said, think Janet Street Porter, but wittier. A forceful extrovert with 20 years experience cajoling abashed men into doing what they are told. Mrs. Whirlwind. I think I'd agree with all of that. I'm not sure about Janet Street Porter, though. That's not very kind. Jackie, you don't get a chance to describe Peter in the book. So how would you describe Peter?
Janet Street Porter has a formidable intellect. I'll bank Janet Street Porter. I'm perfectly happy with that. Peter Bill and I have been friends for, well, more years than I care to admit. And he wasn't just your boss back in the past. He was also my sister's boss back in the past. And I kind of feel I've known Peter possibly, might be 25 years. But anyway, he and I were once having lunch in the Reform Club, as one does. And I was moaning about the housing industry, and I ought to write it down, about the housing crisis. And we cooked up a plan to write this book. And we are a great team, really. I mean, I feel stuff, as you know, very viscerally and don't really overthink things. Just get out and at it. As Peter says, I'm Mrs. Whirlwind. But he is Mr. Institutional Memory. He is super authoritative and deeply cerebral about our industry. So all the stuff in there that's real facts, you know, real analysis, all comes from Peter. All the righteous, self-righteous howls of indignation all come from me. And actually, you know, between us, we're two sides of a coin, really. So I'm deeply privileged to work with Peter Bill, I have to say to you. He trained, he's obviously a trained QS back in the day. He went to work for a house builder, dear old George Wimpey, as they then were. He then went to become editor of Building Magazine. And then he went to become, as we all know, famously, editor of the EG. He's written for all the nationals and all. I mean, you know, you couldn't get a more authoritative or informed person about our industry. So it is a joy to work with Peter Bill. He's also great fun and deeply kind and generous. So, you know, there's nothing not to like, Sam.
Wow. Peter. You should be blushing.
Thank you very much. Are the checks in the post, Jackie? Check them.
Well, that'll be a first, yeah.
So, well, let's talk about the book, which is obviously about the broken housing market and how we fix it, and actually how, to quote it, how bloody hard it is to fix it. And I'd just like to, I guess, go through some of the points in there. And you talk about four main fallacies around the house building problem that we have. And I wonder if you could just talk us through the four of those. I can remind you of them should you need them in bullet point form. So they were: there are not enough homes being built. More new homes will bring house prices down. Planning tinkering can bring about more new homes, and prefab is the answer.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try hard to remember, but I may have to come back to you. I think let's take the first factoid, which is that not enough homes are being built. If you take a look at the ONS data on how many houses are needed, which is founded on what they call household formation figures, which is how people come together over the next 20 years. It takes into account population growth, it takes into account population changes, it takes into account immigration, emigration, et cetera, et cetera. And they reach the conclusion that we need to build about 170,000 new homes a year, which is almost half the 300,000 homes a year that we keep hearing about. Now, that's not to say there isn't a crisis. Of course there is. But the crisis is one of affordability, not of availability. And that's really the first factoid, which I think is just plain wrong. The second factoid you're going to have to remind me of.
More new homes will bring down house prices.
This is perhaps one of the most crass factoids of all. Imagine new house prices tend to be between 15 and 20% higher, than second-hand house prices on a like-for-like basis. And the idea that building 1 or 2% more new houses in an area where at 20% higher prices is going to reduce all house prices is a complete nonsense. I think that what you have to remember is that new house prices are tied above, but tied to the price of second-hand houses. Of course they are. Why wouldn't they be? They can't be tied to anything else. And therefore, it's the price of second-hand houses that determines the base level at the market. Okay, second-hand house prices are the base market. There are 28 million of them or something, as opposed to a few hundred thousand new houses built on top each year. Second-hand house prices move up and down on supply and demand, and the supply on the demand from buyers, and demand from buyers is attached to the economy. When the economy goes down, demand goes down. When demand goes down, house prices stall or go down. And the reverse is the case. So the idea that building more houses will bring prices down is just nonsense. And the third one, what was the third one?
Planning, tinkering with planning will bring about more homes.
This makes me want to scream out loud, this one.
Dear God. You can if you want.
Dear God. The idea that changing the planning system is going to produce more houses is probably the worst one of all, worst factoid of all, bruited about by all parties through the ages at every October at the party conferences. One housing minister or another stands up on their hind legs, both parties, and say, we are going to build 300,000 houses a year. They're not going to build any. What they mean is, they when you get down to it, is that they say they're going to change the planning system in order that 300,000 houses are built here. And it's all very well giving planning permissions and changing the planning system. But it has very little to do with the house builder's risk to build houses. They don't. They build houses not because they've got planning permission. They build houses based on the number of plots they got, on the price at which they want to sell them at, the rate at which they want to sell them at. As somebody said just a couple of weeks ago at a Common Select Committee meeting, if you gave planning permission for the entire Shetland Islands to be covered in houses, none would be built. So the permissions are only vestigially linked to the construction. And changing the planning system is a pit into which many a housing minister will fall, including the next one.
Because there will always be a next one, of course. Yeah. And prefab is the answer, was fallacy number four.
Prefabrication is generally a good thing, I think. But I have some deep reservations, which Jackie knows about, which I'll come back to. But the idea that building houses more efficiently means they will be sold more cheaply is, of course, a nonsense. They are sold at the market price, not at the cost that they cost to put up. And the same goes for rental houses in the social housing market, where they're all going into this modern method of construction stuff. In my view, somewhat dangerously. But the idea they will rent them out more cheaply is, again, nonsense. They will rent them out at whatever rent they rent anything out. Just because the thing's bolted together doesn't make it any cheaper to rent or buy. So that's the first point on MMC. The second point is that I generally think it's a good thing and will come. But take a look at Grenfell. Take a look at what's happened since Grenfell. Take a look at what's going on existing housing sites where people are uncovering all sorts of stuff. And the idea that the house building industry can be trusted with even more complicated things to do than put in cavity barriers is a dangerous assumption. Now, I suspect some of the big builders will be fine and people who are sensible will be fine, but I think we're at the beginning of a process whereby the government is interfering with the market by insisting that Homes England, for instance, build 20% of its houses using modern methods of construction. Talk to the NHBC. There are 40 separate methods now, and by God, at least two of them are going to leak. That's it, really. That's my factoid rant.
I want to understand why these fallacies exist in the first place and why we're allowing them to be perpetuated, when I think it's quite clear, isn't it, that the problem is one of affordability. I think everyone would accept that, but still we are failing really to do anything about it. So I'm going to throw that one at you, Jackie. Why do you think these fallacies exist?
I think they're politically convenient, Sam. I think they are convenient untruths that are just mouthed off platitudinously by minister after minister. I mean, the business about the planning system being the brake on stuff is a long-held shibboleth within the Treasury. Treasury officials at all levels believe that it's the planning system that's to blame. And there are a million homes consented and not built in this country. And, you know, there is nobody who is involved in the planning system in the UK who doesn't think it doesn't need reform. We all believe it needs reform. But I have to say, in the middle of a pandemic, to come out with half-baked reforms seems a little bit ill-advised. I mean, what we now need is market certainty. And we already have had quite, you know, severe indications of stalled sites as a result of the current planning white paper working its way through through the process. And, you know, it's been a stall on delivery. And so, you know, tinkering with the planning system is really not helpful. We do all believe it needs reform, but let's do it properly. And let's do it when we're not in the middle of a health crisis, please. You know, you fix the roof when the sun is shining. And we are, you know, we think it's a fallacy anyway, as Peter's already very eloquently explained, that the planning system is a brake on housing. But we do believe it needs reform. It probably isn't now. Now, what was the second part of your question, Sam? Because I've lost it.
The second part is why do we allow these fallacies to be, these factoids to be perpetuated?
Well, I mean, the short answer is I just don't know. I think it's laziness. I think it's intellectual idleness. This is part of the reason that we wrote this book, actually, is because we were railing in indignation about the fact that people were just clutching at these daft factoids. You know, it's the planning system. You know, there's a housing crisis. Yeah, there is something of a housing crisis. It is several decades in the making. But as Peter says, it is not universal. There isn't a housing crisis in the northwest of England, for instance. You know, so it's a regional thing. And actually, there isn't really a housing crisis at all. What Peter says quite rightly is there's a crisis of affordability, which means we've got a bit of a problem with the fact that our economy is so fiercely predicated on the housing market. And that is a bit of a fault line that runs right through the UK system. And it was that sense that people have to start pointing out that the emperor is wearing no clothes. That was the reason we actually wrote this down, is because, you know, it was just too lazy and too easy and too casual for people just to say, oh, there's a housing crisis. Oh, there's a problem with the planning system. Oh, there's this. Oh, there's that. Oh, if we had MMC, everything would be solved. No, that's not how it is. It's a very nuanced and complicated problem. And what we've attempted to do with our two contributions, Peter on the analysis side and me on the worked example side, is we've tried to prove that actually it's incredibly complicated and that there are no silver bullets. We're not saying it can't be sorted, but it's been at least 20 years, possibly 50 years in the making, and it's going to be at least 20 years till we get it sorted. And we spoke to four housing ministers. I think we spoke to two ex-Labour housing ministers and two ex-Conservative housing ministers, and the almost universal sense from all of them was, yes, this is a long-term, deep-seated problem and we need to sort it, but we're not going to be, and of course most of them weren't in office for more than a year and a half, as we know, and it's a bit of a running joke, you know, that we've had however many it is, 19 housing ministers in 19 years. But it's a deep-seated problem that needs a long-term solution, and it doesn't suit the electoral cycle, and it certainly doesn't suit this revolving door of housing ministers. We need long-term systemic fixes and not just grabbing at straws.
So how do we do that? Does it mean we need smarter, more hardworking people in the right positions? Do we need to somehow as a human race get over the built-in greediness that we have? Affordability is a huge problem. It's a really scary problem for someone to take on. Are you hopeful that somewhere, somehow, we can fix that?
No, you can't get rid of greed. Greed is greed trumps most things. I don't call it greed. It's just a desire for profit. And that is the driving force of the private sector. Can we get smarter? Well, I think on that front, what came also out from the talking to the housing ministers was the amateur nature in which policy is produced. And it is terribly amateur. It is essentially produced by think tanks. And those think tanks then put these ideas towards whatever housing ministers are in charge. And I'm guilty of that myself. I was involved with the think tank in the Labour government and we put forward ideas and they were sort of grabbed at and mulled around and mostly ignored and sometimes put in place. This government is exactly the same. They have a favourite think tank. They have these people who've never done a day's work in industry in their lives who are very clever. They come up with superficially bright ideas on how to solve the housing problem. The starter homes issue, the starter homes idea back in 2015 by Mr. Osborne is a classic example of a SPAD coming to persuading the Chancellor that starter homes are a good idea. It gets lumped onto the whatever housing minister's in charge. It ends up in the manifesto and therefore has to be put into place. It gets put into place, complete disaster. NAO report comes out saying not a single home was built and nobody gets to blame. That side of it needs proper professional management and testing of ideas, not just being chucked in. Now, how that happens about, I have no idea.
Where government could step in very admirably for the long term would be through the regulatory framework. So I'll give you a really good example. We interviewed Barratts for the book and we're impressed with Barratts, I think it's fair to say. Peter and I, we don't agree on everything. Well, we agree totally on this. Barratts are really trying very hard to address the shortcomings of volume house builders as perceived out there. And one of the things they'd really like to do is get to a zero carbon situation, which, of course, obviously is to be applauded. But they can't do it unless there's a regulatory framework which entails all their competitors having to do the same thing. And they are basically asking number 10 and number 11 to put more effort into regulatory restrictions on how they build so that they can, in fact, build to zero carbon. They will continue to try and lead by example, but they can't do everything if their competitors are, you know, cutting and running. So I think there's glimmers of hope there. And I think there's genuinely stuff that government can do very, very plausibly through regulation. But I think this clutching at these mad ideas, and Peter's absolutely right about starter homes. I mean, I was in the department when the starter homes thing landed. And when I say landed, I mean, it landed in terms of pieces of paper. I mean, there were more reports written you could shake a stick at. We didn't deliver one, not one starter home. And, you know, the whole issue of, you know, what actually sounds like a very nice soundbite, starter homes. Actually, if you'd populated that right, that could have captured the public imagination. We could have been off to the races. But of course, it was half baked and half thought through and all the rest of it. And as Peter says, it's quite amateur, this stuff. It's amateur at a time when we need to be much more professional.
And I was really interested what you said there actually about Barratt asking for regulation, which you know, we all know that house builders in particular, the real estate industry more widely, has this awful reputation among Joe or Josephine public. And the fact that a house builder is saying, hey, actually force us to do this so we deliver better, is a really good message that never gets out there, isn't it? And actually places a bit of the emphasis on fixing the problem and doing better on government and on a government that is cross-party, that is a national proposal that should stick whoever is sat at number 10 or number 11.
Yeah, but we do have some fixes. They're not silver bullets, as Jackie said, but there are several fixes. House builders need regulation in order to have a level playing field for themselves. So all the BREEAM stuff, the green stuff, they didn't invent it themselves. They got involved with it and it's all come in. And because they all have to do it, they're all happy with it because they've all incurred the same costs. So that's happened already. I think what we're suggesting is, and sorry, the second thing that's happening is this idea of beauty floating about now like a butterfly, that we ought to make houses beautiful. Now, that has almost no meaning unless you put some measurements in it. And we're rather hoping that that might happen. What we have suggested, the main thrust of it, is that there should be minimum base standards, which should be much bigger than the ones that are now. The ones now are not mandatory. The new ones should be mandatory. They should be 25% bigger than Parker Morris. And there should be maximum density levels as well, because there's been a huge squeeze in the number of homes per hectare over the last 25 years, gone from 25 to over 40, mainly because the flats are being built, but it's still a squeeze. If you have minimum space standards and maximum densities, it means that builders can compete for land on an equal basis because they know how many they can get on the land. Just like they know they've got to compete on bream, they know they have to compete on size, and the size becomes the yardstick for beauty. So that's really what we're suggesting. And what we've tried to do in the book is to show the impact of these diktats on land values, because everybody just comes back to the land values. And hopefully we have described in numbers rather than words the impact of land values on making houses bigger and spacing them out a bit further apart. You can sell them for more for a start, but it does impact the land value. It's backed up by a lot of research by Knight Frank, who did some great work for the Building Better Beautiful Commission to show that it actually can work. So those are the two things that we would like to happen. We would also like to see, I would like to see, this is my favourite one, I think the infrastructure levy put forward by, I think Stuart Lipton was involved somewhere along the line with this one, is a work of genius. Okay, you've flatteringly said you've read the book. Well, as you may have read in one chapter, there's an enormous long list of stupid ideas about how to capture land value, which have never worked for 100 years. They've never worked. The infrastructure levy, which is capturing the land value on the sale or rent of the house at the end of the period, I think is a work of genius and will kill off all this argy-bargy over Section 106s and SIL and replace it with a simple formula.
That provided, works. Of course, that it gets enacted, which yes. is an issue that we do face, doesn't it? That these
we do. But as I've said, it's a work of genius. It's almost bound to happen now. Not.
we can all cross our fingers and hope that somewhere someone is sensible and will see these things through. Now, you talked about those fixes, and there is that is a perfect jumping point actually to talk about UKR, isn't it, Jackie, and what you're trying to do to, I guess, put that into real practice. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about the vision for UKR. I know there's quite a heartfelt couple of chapters in the book about the journey that you've been on that has not always been easy. I wrote down actually love, laughter and losses to sort of describe that journey. But can you give us a little bit of a whirlwind tour of the UKR journey and how you're trying to do your bit to make to build quote unquote beautiful homes, but homes that work for people?
Well, it's a 10-year story, Sam, and you know, at the risk of, you know, treating you like my psychotherapist, I mean it has been a tale of well, twists and turns and quite a lot of woe alongside the love and the laughter, and you know, it has been tricky. But we eventually, after several false starts, which we talk about in the book, we eventually alighted upon a large site in Bedfordshire, because we realised that trying to do 5 acres of inner city Nottingham or 8 acres of inner city Derby was almost as difficult, really, as trying to do an urban extension. What started as an urban extension actually then became an entire new settlement, and then became a rural extension. Actually, extraordinarily, it's sort of morphed. And the joy of a large site, and we've really come down quite hard on the stewarded model, is, and it's a bit like, you know, I copy my old mentors at Urban and Civic, and we are obviously also very close to Grosvenor and others, you know, decent people who are in the market trying to do the right thing. If you've got a large site, you can do the master planning, plan the interstitial spaces, make sure the place looks and feels right, and then you can curate the offer. So the idea of a stewarded model, and I think the Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission are about to come out with a big report on stewardship. This is the way to go. And then joy of joys, Homes England thunderously entered this market about 6 months ago also, and are prepared to partner local authorities or other landowners to bring forward a stewarded model. Now, that means somebody is the custodian of that place. And it means there isn't the kind of slash and burn building that goes on, the kind of chaotic development that you see up and down the country. UKR's mission is incredibly simple. We believe that you can build homes at scale, at a pace, to a quality. You can do that without in any way riding roughshod over the local community or compromising the natural environment. And you can do that commercially. Now, that sounds very simple in you know, when you just say it like that. Oh, and also you can do it in parts of the country where people want to live. But when you actually try to put it into practice, the industry looks at you as if you're completely mad. The idea that you take a long term view of these places. We modelled ourselves, I mean, very hubristically on the old great estates. You know, why is Mayfair rich? Mayfair's rich because somebody's been keeping, the Duke of Westminster and the Grosvenor estate have been keeping an eye on it for 250 years, you know, and it's a stewarded model. And we basically are looking to do a stewarded model in Bedfordshire and shamelessly copying Urban and Civic, who are, of course, the market leaders and our big mates, and of course, now have just been bought by Wellcome Trust. So what an interesting dynamic playing out there. Are we going to see a healthy town? You know, we've had a pandemic. We've now got this very interesting marriage between Urban and Civic and the Wellcome Trust. Are we going to see healthier places? Peter talks about bigger homes. We're very, very keen on bigger homes. We're very, very keen on more access to outside space, more gardens, being more connected with nature, getting fitter. You know, all of that stuff. Well, I mean, you know, the idea that Urban and Civic are in this very signal partnership with Wellcome Trust. I mean, we could be building brand new communities that are really genuinely fit for the new millennium. And I'm very excited by all of that. We'd already coined the term healthy town. We're also a garden community. I have to tell you, I'll take anything that's going. We'll take any label that's going for the Biggleswade villages. So we'd already coined the term healthy town. We didn't really know what that meant. But I tell you what, it's going to be a lot of fun populating that idea. And I'm looking to Urban and Civic and the Wellcome Trust to show the way, really. Very excited about all of that stuff. Very excited about the stewarded model. And I gave a talk to the Association of Chief Estate Surveyors, which is the local authority asset managers. And I basically said to them, your time has come. If you've got land for housing, this is the time to start putting it forward under a stewarded model basis. Homes England will hold your hand. There's plenty of institutional money wants to come in and help you. But for goodness sake, be the custodian of your place. Police the thing like a hawk and make sure that you curate the offer so that it works for your community. And then we go straight to the whole notion of social capital, which I'm kind of hoping will meet your question about the greed in the industry. You're never going to be able to eradicate greed in the industry. You know, we live in a capitalist system. People have to make a profit. But the understanding of social capital, I think, we could see an awful lot of more of that coming forward, particularly post-pandemic.
So I have two questions off the back of that. One being, are local communities empowered enough to take ownership and stewardship, that's hard to say, of a development of a community? And has the time come that there is now this shift, this understanding of social value, enough that when more people like you, Jackie, come into the market and say, this is what we're going to do, they don't get laughed off the stage?
Well, the short answer to both of those questions is no. But the longer answer is, they definitely they have to be the direction of travel, right? Any community, and I said this to the people of Biggleswade when we first went in there, the experts in any community are the people who live there. It's as simple as that. They are the people who know about it. They are the people who care about it. This is why I'm so keen on localism, you know, worked very hard on the government's localism agenda when I was in government. And I think that the whole issue of communities being more empowered and more able to have a say is really important. I have to say, I've just this week got a new planning consent. We did that with the unanimous support of Biggleswade Town Council. And if I hadn't had the unanimous support of Biggleswade Town Council, I'm not sure I would have got that consent. And I needed for them to feel that they had sufficient understanding and ownership of the ideas that we were putting forward, that they felt sufficiently comfortable with them, that they could endorse them. And that was really, really important to me. So I'm very keen on community empowerment. We're not there yet, but I think you will see an awful lot more enlightened developers working much more hand in glove with their community, because it isn't just about, you know, buying people off or consulting or any of that nonsense. It's about actually creating a better product at the end of the day. A community will help you to do that. And then the shift to social value, I think actually we're even further behind on that one, but I think it has to come. There's going to be a big reassessment after we've got through this pandemic. There's going to be a big old reset, you know, and people are going to start to think about what is important to them. We've already seen a flight to bigger homes and to people moving out of cities and all of the rest of it. And I think you will see that shift towards an understanding of social value and social capital coming forward. I mean, you know that we're onto something, Sam, when the mainstream real estate consultancies start talking about the sorts of models we're talking about. So there are, you know, just in the last 2 weeks, I've had conversations with, Peter mentioned Knight Frank, and they were ahead of the pack. Knight Frank have been on this. They understand this. They're creating a business line around the stewarded model. Carter Jonas are in this space. Bidwells are in this space. Savills are in this space. If the mainstream real estate consultancies are moving into this space, then you know that that is the direction of business travel.
Thank you, Peter.
I just add a couple of points, really. I think the first one is that you need a catalyst in order to make things happen in local areas. And there aren't many Jackies around, and there aren't many urban and civics around. And unless you have somebody to come in and bang the drum, it's difficult to make these things happen, is all I would say. You need somebody with immense patience. You need somebody like Roger Madeline down at Canada Water, you know, somebody who's going to run around on his bike for 5 years trying to persuade everybody that these things need to be done. The second thing I would say is on the social value thing, as a former quantity surveyor, I actually tried in the book to quantify it. And as you can see, I won't go into too many details, but it is quantified in the difference between the residual land value of the site where we worked out there would be 1,500 homes on, and the site on which there would be two, on the same size site in which there would be 2,000 homes on. And the number came out at £23 million. So in other words, the residual land value was £23 million less on the site where there were fewer houses than on the 2,000 houses site. And if you like, the price of giving people bigger houses spaced more widely apart worked out at £23 million on 1,500 homes.
Can our industry swallow that price, do you think?
Well, yes, because the land value is still above zero. In other words, it can. And what helps it swallow it is the fact that you get paid. If you do it that way, the model has also got in it increase in value as well, because you can sell these houses for, and this is Knight Frank figures, not mine, 12 to 15% more than the houses that were squeezed together. And remember, within this land value model, you've got house builders making their usual 20% margin on the prices they're charging anyway. So it's not like they're losing profit. I'm just talking about the reduction in the land value, not the reduction in profits being made by the house builders.
So if we've done the maths that shows, okay, so you might quote unquote lose this on the land value, but your gain is X percent.
Yes.
So £23 million loss actually turns into a whatever profit.
Yes, it's the balancing figure is that there's more income and the same outgoings, but fewer houses equals a lower land value. That sounds a bit complicated, but you have to really get into land value appraisals to see where it works, see how it works. But essentially, your income goes up, your costs remain about the same, and the net sum is that the land value drops, the residual land value drops by that figure, that 23 million. And that, to me, is the only way you can really measure social value. And the social value is you've got bigger houses, space further apart, and people with decent sized gardens. Is that worth the price? And please remember that the house builders are still making 20% on what they build.
I think it's worth the price, but I would say that, wouldn't I? People would expect me to say that. You talked about as well there, Peter, that we need the catalysts, we need more Jackies, we need more Rogers of this world. Where do we find those people? How do we look for them? And I guess this comes to my, you know, one of my drums that I bang a lot, which is, you know, the whole D&I question, isn't it? It's where we go looking for people who have a different view to the traditional and might bring those different thoughts to the market and different principles too, I suppose.
I don't know the answer, frankly. I don't know where you go. You know them when you see them, but where you find them, that's a very interesting question. And I don't know. You're probably looking for people who are a bit ornery and a bit unwilling to accept the normality and who are clear in their view that we should be doing more for the people who end up in these houses. As you know, there's one chapter in the book called Ghosts in the Machine, and it's quite clear that nobody really gives a lot of thought to the people who live in the houses. Not at all, really, apart from wanting to sell them to them. They're regarded as a minor inconvenience. So I think perhaps where you need to go is where Jackie's boss has come from, Jason Blaine. He's come from a marketing background in the world, BBC and Sony. And he's come in and gone, what in God's name is going on here? We're not actually looking after the clients, and we want to do something better. So I think you have to look outside the house building world. You also have to look outside, I'm afraid, the social housing sector, which frankly is freighted with debt and problems, and it can't really escape as far as I can see. I think you have to look outside the world of the build to rent, because that's all they want to do. It's quite a nice model, it's working quite well, but they're not really interested in building pounds. You have to find Nigel Hughill somewhere, you have to find Robin Butler somewhere, you have to find Jackie somewhere, and there aren't many of them. That's all I would say. On the public side, I think mayors are probably the answer. You have to get the mayor involved, and of course you have to let, they all have to take a copy of Broken Homes and read it thoroughly before they even start.
And we'll do the plug at the end of the podcast of where people can buy it. Don't worry. I think like this conversation always makes me laugh, because real estate always talks about how it's a people industry, but then it never ever thinks about the people. And we, you know, over the last 18 months, 2 years, we've heard people talking about, oh, you know, customer centric, and it's all to excuse my friend, it's all a bit of bollocks, isn't it? And if you look at it, if you stand back and look at it, it's not about the people, or, you know, or very, not very often is it really about the people. It's about the bottom line. And, you know, that making that shift and looking to people who are brave enough to stand up and say, I'm not going to do it that way, is a really, I think, a really exciting journey, but going to be a tough one.
I think that I think on the commercial side, and let's just take offices for the sake of simplicity, where their people go, I think they think about them a lot more than house builders think about the people who move into houses. And they're now obviously terrified that not many people are going to work in the offices. So I think, you know, if you look at the British Council for Office, for instance, they spend their life trying to work out how people should work in offices. And on the residential side, there is a total void. So I think it's a bit unfair to say that on the office side, they don't think about people. They've certainly stopped thinking about how to pack them in, haven't they? So I'm not quite with you there. But on the residential side, the gap is just nothing. There's nothing there.
It's almost scandalous, actually, the gap. And Peter talks about, you know, just mentioned Jason Blaine, who's my business partner. I mean, he comes in, as I say, as Peter says, from another industry. And he made several very shrewd observations about our industry. And the first was that it doesn't learn from any other industry, almost uniquely. It doesn't do, there's no read across from other industries. The second is an absolute, you know, almost willful ignoring of the consumer. Extraordinarily. And the PRS sector is, I mean, absolute, you know, complete example of this. If anybody's involved in build to rent or PRS starts talking about the model, they will always start with yield. There's never any mention of actually who lives in these places. I can remember seeing a really, you know, really super presentation from one of the big PRS, you know, breaking into the PRS market, which was all about monetizing what that people had friends in the same building. You know, that if somebody had got one friend in the building, then they were more than 30% likely to stay. If they had two friends in the building, they were 60% likely to stay. I mean, it's the most extraordinary kind of cynical, dissociative attitude to the way that people live their lives. And Peter's absolutely right. The house builders in particular are very good at selling you a property. Once they've done that, that's it. You've got no further relationship with the people who have provided that property. You know, you'd never ever go to Procter and Gamble and say to them, tell us about Fairy Liquid, and they'd immediately start with the IRR. They tell you that it was all about hands that do dishes that are soft as your face. It would all be about brand values. They would populate the fact that they owned this brand, Fairy Liquid. It would all be the narrative around what sort of product it was. There is no real narrative around the products of either volume house builders or housing associations. Nobody, you know, who wants, say, a lifetime home, i.e. a home they can get old in, can immediately think of somebody that they could go to, you know, that would have that sort of product. There's no narrative or development of any ideas behind all these players in the market. There's just this kind of very transactional, one time you meet your consumer and then you leg off into the sunset with your bag full of swag and you don't ever talk to them ever again. And it's just tragic, really. It's dissociative and it is not what other industries would do.
It is tragic, isn't it? Because actually we could tell wonderful stories if we got it right.
You could. And to go back to the fact that Peter was at George Wimpey for 10 years, Jason Blaine, my business partner, was brought up in a George Wimpey house in the outskirts of Glasgow and talks about it so fondly. And I think back in those days, you knew what you were getting. You kind of, there was a bit of that happened with the wondrous Tony Pidgley's Berkeley Homes. You knew what you were getting, but not enough, really. Not enough. Could you really tell the difference between one volume house builder's product and another? I'm not sure. I now realise, because Peter's taught me this, that not all volume house builders are the same. And I also realise that not all that within any one volume house builder, you will have a range of qualities of products. There'll be rubbish down the one end, there'll be quite a good product offer up the other end, and you've got to really get the house builders to deliver their best product to you. So they're not all the same. It's not all homogenous, but there is no narrative around each of these different products, each of these different firms with their brands. They don't have anything that discerns one from another. And that, I think, is an opportunity lost.
Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't got long left on this podcast, I'm assuming that everyone who is listening is getting to the end of their 10, 15, 25-mile run, as they all do, I'm sure. And so I just want to do a quick few quick fire rounds, I suppose, because we have not yet talked about the wonderful world of PD. So thoughts and feelings on PD. We actually have a story in EG this week talking about how actually numbers of PD has slumped, which is really interesting. And obviously we had the announcement yesterday on the ban on PD homes under, what is it, that don't mean size, Sander, so under 37 square metres, they are not allowed from April next year. Peter, I know you have some thoughts on PD.
I do indeed. My first thought when it came in was, what a jolly good idea, get rid of all that planning red tape. And it became such a jolly good idea because there was a great deal of money in it. And instantly, people with clapped out old office blocks could see the money that was coming. And there are one or two examples in the book to show how much money there was to be made in it, or at least to be made in trading the office blocks to somebody else who could then make money out of them. So that's the first point I'd make. And it seemed like a good idea. It was one of these new red tape slashing good ideas back in 2013. But of course, they don't think through the consequences. This is going back to this amateurishness again. The consequences are that if you let people get away with almost outrageous things that you can't imagine them doing, they will go for it. They will make money out of putting people in squalid little blocks of flats, and they will squeeze it down as far as they dare. And you cannot expect them to do anything else than do that. And that's what they did. And finally, you know, 5 or 6 years later, the government has decided, in the face of overwhelming evidence and 5 years of people telling them, to introduce space standards, which is a good thing. So it's come out all right in the end, but it's another example of how things, people will do everything they can to make money if they can allow to get away with it. This is why you need minimum space standards.
And another reason for regulation, regulation and red tape isn't always the bad thing.
Of course.
Jackie, any thoughts from you on PD?
I used to, like Peter, I used to be well in favour of PD. I mean, before it became an accepted norm, you know, the idea of converting offices to residential seemed to me to be an excellent idea. And certainly, you know, all the ones that happened before the PD legislation came in, whenever it was 10 years ago, I thought were very fine examples as well, indeed, because they went through the planning system and therefore they were regulated. The current PD, the policy, terrifies the life out of me, partly because of my work with Bill Grimsey on the high street. I can see our heritage assets in town centres and high streets being, you know, roughshod conversions and being a disaster. And, you know, it goes back to the need to curate your offer. I mean, the whole thing about PD is it will rip like wildfire through some of these places. You know, in areas with high housing demand, you know, you'll end up completely decimating your town centres and being inappropriately changed into residential, where actually what you should be having is more community uses in the town centre, not perhaps retail, but educational, health or whatever else, so that you've still got a community hub. I'm terrified of PD in town centres, terrified.
I think I'll just make one last point on PD. Give me the name of one respectable developer who is happy to be known to be building PD. No.
Quite right.
Yeah, names on a postcard if people can think of any and send them in to us, and we will talk to them and find out just how proud they are. Second quickfire question would be around COVID. So whether you think that we will actually learn something from this period in time, or as our reaction to an announcement of a potential vaccine showed us, we'll just quickly bounce back and go back to life as normal. Peter,
right, okay. I think it will take about a couple of years, and I think life will go back to normal-ish. I think, as you've, I think you probably said it in your column this morning, you know, I think, you know, people won't go to work on Fridays, but did they anyway? Another point put to me by Stuart Lipton was, guess what the occupancy rates of most offices are in normal times? 43%. So in other words, they were never fully occupied anyway. I do think long-term office values will obviously fall. I mean, there's no question of that because of the supply and demand and the redundancies of some of the rubbish office blocks around. So that's that. On the housing side, at the moment, there's this move towards having more space because people want to work at home. But I think it's deeper than that. It's deeper because people want bigger outside space as well as inside space. And they want gardens again. And they want, you know, not to be cheap by jowl, not to be living in houses that are 11 feet 9 inches wide, with gardens that are 11 feet 9 inches wide, and where they're over three floors. It's a 750 square foot house, but it's over three floors, which means only a third of the house is living space. A third, not a half, not something that I've noticed anybody writing about. Because there's more money in building three-storey houses. And I think those sorts of things will change. I think I would hope that COVID will have a marginal but beneficial change on how people think of houses.
Thank you, Peter. Jackie?
Well, I of course agree with my learned friend. I mean, I think what the pandemic's done really is it's accelerated trends that were happening in the marketplace anyway. So, you know, the demise of the high street has, you know, had, you know, certainly has been accelerated by the pandemic. I think the flight to bigger houses in more rural locations. I mean, we're 40 minutes up the line from King's Cross in Biggleswade, and we were already planning for homes where people only did 3 days commute. You know, they worked the other two or three days from home. That was already a trend. That trend, I think, is set to stay. You know, the idea that, you know, you're 10 deep on the station platform at 7 o'clock in the morning, people aren't going to put up with that anymore. So I think you're going to see an awful lot of things that were trends in how we were evolving as a society. Anyway, those are going to be accelerated. I think there will be a certain amount of going back to normal, as you say, Sam. I mean, I think, you know, we're all yearning for our old days. Certainly Peter and I are yearning for lunch. You know, we are the people what lunch. So I think there'll be a certain amount of going back to the old times. But we're never going to be the same, are we? We're never going to be quite the same. My son-in-law works for HSBC in Canary Wharf. There's 12,000 people who work in that building. To get them all into the building at the moment under social distancing rules takes 8 hours. That would be how long it would take to get them all into the building because of the lifts and what have you. So, yeah. So, you know, I'm with you completely. You know, I think there will be a certain amount of resetting. But I think in the main, you know, there will be the trends have been accelerated, but but we will in the main go back to normal.
OK, last question. So the UKR motto, tagline, mission is everyone deserves better. Are we going to do better and deliver better as a residential community and on a commercial front as well, maybe the real estate industry as a whole? Jackie?
Well, let's hope so. I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, I'm an elderly woman who's gone back into the fray and has, you know, basically started a business in order to try and demonstrate that everyone deserves better. And, you know, if I can demonstrate that, I'm kind of hoping others will emulate, will follow the example. And when we say everyone deserves better, we actually mean everyone, not just our consumers. You know, the people who live in our homes, they're really important. You know, the people who have a front door key and go into one of our homes and have an experience, those people are the most important people to us. But actually, you know, the supply chain deserves better. The employees deserve better. The industry deserves better. It's all a little bit kind of shoddy at the moment. And we could really imbue much more quality right the way throughout. It would buy into the notion of social capital. It means taking a long-term view, so that's not always very fashionable, but I do think it will be more beneficial and more profitable in the long run.
Thank you. Peter?
Of course we all deserve better. What is better, though? I don't know. I think I'll leave Jackie on the residential side. She's explained that more eloquently than I could. I think on the commercial side, I take a slightly more benign view. I think those who are good try and do better. Those who are medium try and just get on the way they are. And there are those who are not very good at anything who will carry on just trying to maximize their bottom line. That's the sort of industry it is, really. There are graduations in it. We know who the good guys are, and we know who the bad guys are, and we know who the middling guys are. And you find generally that the good guys tend to flourish more than the bad guys. So we know who the good agents are, and we know who the bad agents are. And those that are really trying to do better by their staff, by their customers, tend to do better. And those developers who tend to look more closely at the way in which they deal with their customers tend to do better than those that don't. So there's always going to be those who do better. Those who don't do very well will continue to do not very well. And those at the bottom will continue to make a buck. I think that's essentially what I would suggest will happen.
The wonderful virtuous circle.
Yeah.
Well, so one thing that people can't possibly deserve better than is an hour of listening to both of you talk really passionately and honestly about the sector, about the book, which, let's do the plug now. If people want to buy Broken Homes, where do they go to get it?
They need to buy it direct at the moment, which is where we are in November the 12th, I think, isn't it? They need to go direct to the publisher. Amazon are, I won't start, but don't go to Amazon. You can actually buy a box set on Amazon, but you can't. So direct to the publisher. I think there is a link, which perhaps you can you put a link on this somehow?
I can put a link on this.
Yeah, so if I'll send you a link, and then people press the link and they go to the publisher. And it also saves us giving Mr. Bezos 60% of the cover price.
He certainly doesn't need that. And
you can order it from Waterstones as well, I might say.
Excellent. And we should all support our local bookshops as well. And if it's in there, go in when we're allowed and buy the book. It is a really good read. It's simpler enough for me to understand, which is always beneficial. I hope that there will be another one at some point in the future. Peter, come on, you know you've got at least one more in you. But for now, thank you so much for joining the EG Property Podcast. I know we could have gone on for probably at least another hour. It's such a pleasure. I can see you, listeners can't, but seeing you and chatting with you today.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the EG Property Podcast. We hope you found the content insightful and helpful. If you'd like more of the same and to keep up with all the latest news, views, analysis and research that the EG Group has to provide, be sure to sign up to all of our property podcasts and subscribe to Radius Data Exchange for unlimited access to all of our content and comprehensive commercial real estate data.